This program is the core of the matter. It's a current affairs, current events program. I'm Steve Corey, your host. My guest today once worked for CIBC, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. Before coming to Salmon Arm in 1976, he owned The Observer till 1987. And then he started Wicket Business Services in 1989, he tells me, and he was a counselor from 1990 to 1993, and then mayor from 93 to 96, and served on the board of the Okanagan University College. Ian Wicket was president of the Chamber of Commerce, and he tells me he's still involved in the Downtown Improvement Association and others. Welcome, Ian Wicket, to core of the matter.
Thank you, Steve.
I just had to get my switches straightened out there. I have one very quick question, Ian, based on your... thanks for coming in, by the way. Thanks for coming into our studios. What do you think?
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's very interesting.
Good. I wonder if your experience on council as mayor in the 90s could inform us today. Do you think there was experiences there that would help us understand how to approach some of the issues of today?
Well, there certainly was a lot of controversy and a lot of development took place in the community while I was on council. So there's certainly a lot of experience to be brought forward. Whether we can learn lessons from it is another matter. I don't know.
Okay. Well, that's what we're going to deal with next week for sure. And tonight, what I would like to talk about are some of the experiences you had and how it affects or it informs, as I call it, what we're doing today. You talked about there was a lot of development then. Was there much controversy around the developments?
Well, there was a lot of development taking place during the early 90s in Salmon Arm. It was actually one of the fastest growing periods in Salmon Arm's history. We were also preparing the official community plan, the basis of which is still used today, and it was a completely rewritten document. So there was a significant number of development issues happening, and some of them were quite controversial. We had a number of large public hearings where the entire community center was full with people and lasting many hours. And so
you had
no stranger to that sort of thing.
No. Okay. So there were public hearings, and I asked you this off air, and it's an interesting answer that you gave me. The public hearings are not a numbers game. In other words, if you get really a whole bunch of people that are for it and just a few that are opposed, that should be council's direction.
Yeah, the public hearings are designed to get the input of people, to get a different perspective, to bring all the issues that should be considered to the table. It is the job of council to then consider what they've heard and weigh the arguments and weigh them against their previous information and arrive at a decision.
Okay, this is an important point, I think, they are not bound by if there's a whole bunch of people opposed, let's say, and just a few that are for, I'm going to reverse it, they're not bound by that. It's a more of an information exercise.
That's correct.
Okay. Was there any controversy around the environment in the 1990s?
Oh, yes. That was when the...
wetlands?
When the area on the lake side of the tracks was being developed. It started probably in 1988, but while I was on council, there was development down there. There were certainly environmental issues concerning that.
Okay, and what was the procedure then to deal with? Was there an environmental assessment?
I think the processes have become more refined than they were back then.
Okay. One of the things that we're going to talk about a little further on, I hope we get time for it, is urban density and this question of smart growth, they call it now. I don't think it was around in the 90s, but was there any talk of urban density keeping the downtown, trying to get people, in other words, preventing urban sprawl?
That was one of the key features of the official community plan that was developed in the early 90s, was its strategies for limiting growth and directing growth to concentrate it.
Yes.
And there were environmental and social reasons, but there are also economic reasons, and that certainly started out as my prime driver toward promoting density, and then I began to see all the other benefits as well.
Yes, okay. Do you think that the present council is allowing enough citizen input or encouraging engagement of the people of Salmon Arm?
I've seen no evidence that they are not engaging the public on issues where the public should be engaged.
Good.
I think that I have found the idea of holding their meetings during the afternoon to be a step in the opposite direction. There's a limited number of people who could attend an afternoon meeting. Not that anyone ever attends the evening meetings, but they do have the opportunity to.
Yeah, there's possibly a reason. What do you think the reason is that people don't attend these meetings at night? Or let's say when they were having them at night.
Because they're, to a large extent, not of an engaging nature. There's a lot of relatively routine things that have to be done that are not intrinsically very interesting.
Yeah. But I guess for other things they could be. I mean, certain issues like development, let's say, and when there's a variance or there's a change in zoning.
Yeah. One thing that is positive now for certain, and it's a function of technology, is that people can see all the council papers, all the reports to council, because they're posted online on the website before the meeting, and they remain thereafter. So people do have an opportunity to be far more informed than they did back when I was on council.
Yes, where they just handed you a whole sheath of paper and said, here, read this, and we'll be in the chambers in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good point, that all that information is online.
Yeah.
Is, in your view, is Salmon Arm right now growing fast enough, or should it be slowing down? Or that's the first question.
My impression would be that right now Salmon Arm isn't growing at all. But
oh, do you want to tell me why you think that is so?
Well, why do I think it's so? I mean, there's been a definite downturn in the economy.
Okay.
Things are not robust. There's not the local jobs here. I don't see a lot of economic activity that would lead me to think growth, but.
Yeah, that obviously that's one of the things. I think in one of your articles, you said that economic activity, whether it be commercial, industrial, lags population growth.
That was my experience from when I first came here in 1976. The town grew for a while, and then there was a lot of construction of commercial buildings and stuff, and then. It was a sort of a catch-up thing, you know, and then that went on for another cycle of 5 or 6 or 7 years, and then there was another spurt in growth. So it seemed that that there had to be the demand built up before people were willing to take the chance and put up commercial buildings and open new stores.
What is, in your opinion, what is it that could attract industry to Salmon Arm? Or is there something we can do, or is it just... I realize we're in an economic downturn, I think we use, but let's ask that question.
I think that the thing we can do most to attract any business or industry to Salmon Arm is to make Salmon Arm a wonderful place to live, to preserve the natural amenities, to enhance the built amenities, you know, the education, the arts, the sports facilities, and make it a great place to live.
And then people will come here. Industry will come?
I don't know that industry will come, but there will be a good reason for them to come.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody, it doesn't matter who it was, who mentioned to me not a program, it was like an exercise to get people to come to the industrial park. And they specifically targeted Alberta, and I think it involved jeans, and it involved the cost of labor mm-hmm. here as opposed to the cost of labor in Alberta. Are you familiar with that targeted? I think it was a program.
I am aware of the program. I wasn't familiar with it. I didn't know to whom it was specifically directed or what the effect of it was.
Yeah, it's something that when I was told about it, it rang a bell because. In good parts of many parts of Alberta, because of the oil patch and the wages are much higher than they are here. And a living wage here could be as $15, $17, $20 an hour, whereas in Alberta it's probably $25 or $30. Hmm. Would you agree? Or
I'm not in the labor market business. I really don't know.
No. Okay, but I think there's lots of room in the industrial park, is there not?
There's certainly room.
Yeah. Yep. But so what I'm getting at is if you have any ideas on how we can attract, it's difficult. I agree.
Yep. I've witnessed over the years a large number of different schemes to attract people. Some of them have been successful. Almost none of the attracted businesses have stayed around for any length of time. I am not sure that it's a highly effective use of our time to try and attract businesses here who haven't already got an interest in coming, who haven't got a natural purpose to be here. I think we need to make the place welcoming and remove impediments to them coming.
How can we make it more welcoming?
Well, I think I expressed the idea of making the town, you know, a much more livable, pleasant place to live. We have an industrial park which is zoned. The land's readily available, is available. If there is infrastructure things that should be done out there, let's do them. But, that's what I mean by a welcoming environment.
Yeah. Yeah, that for industry. I know that Money Magazine just gave us a fairly high rating.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people I talk to, I always ask people when they come on the show or people that I know, why did you move to Salmon Arm? And it's answers are quite glowing. Mm-hmm. Salmon Arm ranks pretty high in the environment, the people, the size of the town, mm-hmm. great place to raise kids.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. It's always I'm looking for that secret magic that you might have hidden in your sleeve there about how we can attract people to Salmon Arm.
I don't think there is magic. I think it's really basic, and it's it's a matter of creating a community that people would want to live in?
It would be understandable then that there are many people here that would like to see construction because there's usually high-paying jobs and people that can get involved in that trade that, you know, would welcome any construction, whether it be residential, commercial, or something like the smart centers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's carry on. Do you think that the city is on a sound financial footing right now?
I have been concerned. I haven't looked at it in any detail for 3 or 4 years, but the last time I looked at it, I thought that we had more debt than I like to see for a community our size and for the assessment we have. But that could have changed over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Okay. It's just a general question. I'm not looking for any controversy or anything. I think that could be the essence of another program, the whole question of borrowing. I'm a member of what's called COMER, the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, and they've argued for years, and they've been around for quite a number of years, that we should be using the Bank of Canada for more low-interest or no-interest loans, both for provinces, federal, and for the municipalities, mm-hmm. where borrowing and the cost of interest can be pretty high. Anyway, I'm a relative newbie to this area. I've only been here for 9 years, and I live at White Lake. So I wasn't here in the 90s. Were there any real, we talked about controversies with respect to growth. Were people arguing that the foreshore, as an example, especially with respect to wetlands, should be protected? Was there a strong commitment to that?
Yeah, there was a significant group who were arguing that, yes.
And were they... Their arguments were their arguments, I don't like to say listened to, but did they have any weight? I mean, were they, well, was there quite a few of them, or was it just a voice crying in the wilderness?
No, I think during the period I was on council, particularly the first 3 years, there was a significant number of us who agreed with that argument, and... So it was definitely taken into account in decision-making. And there were some compromises reached on things that allowed things to happen but preserved parts of the foreshore.
Yes. Well, there's Salmon Arm Bay Environmental Society, SABNES.
Salmon Arm Bay Nature Enhancement Society.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. I've got a terrible memory. I had Tom Brighouse in here, and he was one of the founders, was he not?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, and that was an interesting discussion we had about... All right, let's get into something more, along the lines of what we're getting at. You know, there's another issue that's coming up, and it's a major capital expenditure before the council currently. I think it's that proposed Ross Street underpass. It seems to have a fair amount of support, I believe, and it has detractors. So I guess my question is, what's the process? That will they have public hearings for that, for this, or... First thing they've done, I think, is they've not allotted, what is it, $40,000 for a, what is it?
A lease on property on the other side of the tracks.
Yeah. No, I don't think they've gone for that yet. It's just to determine the cost.
Oh.
And
they've also done that, yeah.
Yeah.
$40,000 to determine the cost of doing an engineering study. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that does not commit them to the project.
No.
No. Will there be, we talked about this off air, if there's major borrowing required, they have to go to referendum, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Yeah. To determine, now whether or not, we don't know how much it's going to cost the city. I mean, we've heard this number, $9 million tossed around.
Yeah.
But that may not really be what it's going to cost. There's a few people. Who else are involved in paying for it?
Well, there's... Certainly the CPR I believe, are interested in paying a share, whatever that may be. There may be senior governments who are prepared to contribute. Mm-hmm. So
the first step was this letting of a contract to determine, somebody has to, some engineers have to come up with a plan and a cost. Could you explain the rest of the process for something like this or how it should roll out?
Well, I mean, the requirements are that if there's to be money borrowed, that it has to be put to a referendum so the people approve the borrowing. There's no, unless there's rezoning required of any of the properties, which is probably not true. When you're dealing with right-of-ways, so there would not be any requirement for a public hearing. I would think that if I were on council and wanted to have a successful referendum, I would make sure that the process was relatively open as I went along, so that when people came to vote, they were voting from an informed position rather than rumors and innuendo.
Yeah. The referendum, though, is only required if they have to borrow. Do you think they
That's
could?
Correct.
They'd have to borrow probably to get this thing done. There's no way they've got any cash reserves that are going to.
Well, at the level that's being bandied about, I'm sure they'd have to borrow.
Yeah.
I mean, the councillors themselves have said they would have to borrow.
So there would have to be a referendum.
Yeah.
And then the referendum period, first of all, would they go to public hearings prior to a referendum?
No, there's no requirement for a public hearing.
Okay, so you mentioned that. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, so then referendum, what would be sort of like the period that they, I don't want to call it a campaign, but...
I don't know. I can't even remember the last couple I was involved in. I don't know, maybe there were 6 weeks, 8 weeks. I really don't know.
I was not living in Quebec during the referendum of 1980, but I do recall that Quebec has, that's a province though, it has some pretty strict regulations concerning referendums, so that each side has, that they specifically wanted to have an opportunity to they wanted to win their referendum, the Parti Québécois. But are there any restrictions on referenda, in British Columbia, for instance, that each side must have an equal amount of resources, or is there anything like that?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
There certainly wasn't in the past. Of course, the Elections Act has changed significantly, as has the Municipal Act. And whether there's new fairness rules that have been put in, I don't know. But I would be very surprised if they dictated some form of fairness. There might be limits on the amount you could spend on it, but there would be no requirement for equal resources.
Just a quick aside, it is a little bit of a... Kitimat just had their plebiscite. Now, we realize that a plebiscite is non-binding. What's your thoughts on that plebiscite, and what does it mean? I mean, one of the things I heard was that Enbridge put in a lot of resources to try and win that. A lot of resources. They brought in teams, etc. What's your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are derived from second or third hand information, and I too have heard that Enbridge put a lot of resources into it. Some people say that it was a narrow majority, but a 60-40 split is fairly significant in a public vote like that, a yes-no vote. I suspect that there's a lot of concern about the shipping and.
Oh, that itself, the issue itself is huge.
Yeah.
But the plebiscite interests me too, because I recall hearing on the radio, of course, CBC, that when they interviewed the the no side, they were quite concerned about the amount of resources that Enbridge was putting into their campaign. I mean, there was a lot of money and teams coming in from Calgary or something to help them. And still to get that 60, or I think it was 58 point something, it wasn't quite 59, opposed. Anyway, let's get on with it. That's Kitimat. What do you have to say about development, Ian, on the waterfront?
What do I have to say about development on the waterfront?
Yes.
I mean, the development that has occurred is there. I'm not aware of new proposals at this point.
All right, I'll refine my question. Should there be continued farther east along the shore there? Continue buildings, or should there be more public access, or what do you think?
Well, there's no land available for development to the east of the wharf, basically, up to where it is now. And the pass there, there's nothing there. I would like to see more public access. I personally would like to see access all the way around to canoe, to have a trail that leads all that way. But there are private property issues.
Yeah. And one of the things that I found, I don't know, does it apply here? Isn't there supposed to be public access every so many meters, 200 meters?
I'm not aware of that.
In British Columbia, any water, I understood. Now, I don't know if that's true. I know that in Tawasin we had a bit of a dispute with Tawasin Beach on the west side there to get public access. What kind of development would you see on the, you mentioned public access, on the west side then, or more to the west? There's a fair number of residences there. Is there still any land to be developed over there?
There are lots in the existing subdivisions. There are three or four vacant lots. So they're residential lots. There's a lot of land that should be intended to be developed as commercial development in front of the Prestige, and I don't see that as affecting things adversely because it's inland of the existing development.
Okay.
Then we have the reserve, which we have no jurisdiction over. So there's not, and there is some further highway frontage on the between the reserve land and Smart Center. So.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh yeah, okay. Right by the river.
Well, I'm thinking where Joey's Only is.
Oh yes.
Or what it used to be, Joey. I don't know.
No,
if it's still
something seafood. Yeah.
Something seafood.
Yeah. I'm sorry. There, I can't remember the name myself. They're from actually from Enderby. They came from Enderby. The region's best. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about development, but getting back to this, the underpass, I have one paragraph from a listener concerning that development, the underpass, and he wrote in right after I had Jim Kimmerly and Warren Bell on this program just a couple of weeks ago discussing, about 3 weeks ago, I think, or 4 weeks ago, discussing the underpass, and I quote from this gentleman here, I quote, "Both speakers on the program agreed that a process that thoroughly engages the public in providing ideas for how they would like to see the waterfront develop is a necessary step, and sooner than later. Perhaps the underpass would come out as a high priority, but perhaps not. Perhaps the capital investment in an underpass could be better spent on amenities for the waterfront itself to make it more attractive and enjoyable for residents and tourists alike." Do you have any comment?
Well, I think that it would be wise of any city council to explore ideas for development and for accessing the waterfront. There isn't a formal process set up for that, and I don't know that they're, I'm trying to envision one. I'm not sure that there would be a particularly useful one, that useful process that would not be subject to a small number of interested people having a significant role in it, you know, and with one point of view. So I think they should be open to gathering information, but to go into some sort of a binding process to have the people decide is probably not something I would support.
Okay, binding, yeah, I understand. There's a lot of arguments or even numbers thrown around. Some people have expressed concern that there's no way of tracking. For instance, it's been argued that tourists don't stop in Salmon Arm because they have difficulty accessing the waterfront because of the crossing, the level crossing. That, I don't know. There's been a counter argument to that. With respect to the smart centers, there were quite a number of arguments, and we're going to get to that next week. Not necessarily the pros and cons, but what sort of methods were used to track whether or not the arguments for, let's say, you know, we're talking about people. I don't think there is any evidence, actual hard empirical evidence, that so many people were shopping out of town. I know in one or two of your articles that you allude to it. But is there any tracking of this kind of information that you know of?
There is. There's accepted statistical means of calculating how this information is of how where people shop and where they earn their money and where they live, there are. There are differences in interpretation, and that was one of the issues that arose during the Smart Center development hearings and the process was whether whose interpretation of those statistics was accurate.
Yeah, that's always a problem, and I suppose unless they can unpack those statistics, and of course you can make them say what you want, I realize that.
Yeah.
I want to. In 2009, you wrote, and I quote, "There is a real disconnect between those arguing for the Smart Center on the former Petty Meat site and those opposing it. I am not talking about the wide differences in opinions, but about the lack of engagement in the discussion of the serious questions posed by the proposed development." Can you tell me what you're really getting at there?
Well, I feel that there were differing camps and involved in the process, and that there was a lack of engagement with the arguments. In other words, there was a lack of listening to the other side's argument and actively addressing the argument. What is the argument valid? Are the premises behind that argument valid? And these are the reasons why it is not, and why our arguments are valid. Instead, it was like two people giving, instead of having that discussion with each other, standing up and giving a speech with no regard to what the other person had said or the value of their ideas. And I think both sides were guilty of that. I was even guilty of that on some occasions of dismissing arguments, not because of I addressed the merits of the argument, but because it didn't lead in the direction that I wanted to see.
Well, one of the nice things about the internet, and I refer to Aim High Salmon Arm, is it's fairly high-level discussion, and I know there are others, and I'm not the expert, so please pardon me for zeroing in specifically on Aim High Salmon Arm, but there's some good blogs and discussion going on that would take some of these issues and discuss them. Is that?
I did not see much of that. There was some of that, but by the in large, there did not seem to be an engagement on the issues. There was some engagement on a personal level, an ad hominem argument, but not a lot of engagement on the issues.
That particular issue, the smart centers, and especially where it's located with respect to the distance from downtown, one of the things you also wrote is, and I quote, "Is urban density a valid concept that we want for Salmon Arm?" End quote. Yep. Was that question ever answered?
No, and not to me. I never got the feeling that the side that was pro-development was arguing that urban sprawl is a bad idea. And I would have been interested in hearing those arguments, why it's beneficial to our personal finances, why it's beneficial to our health, why it's beneficial to our social relations, why it's beneficial to the economics of our municipality to have sprawl. Because I remain totally unconvinced that there are valid arguments, and I haven't heard them expressed yet. And
there's valid arguments for urban density.
I think, yes.
Yes.
But I haven't heard the arguments against it.
No, and it seems to be something that has happened, you in your article, you talked about how we've designed things mainly for the automobile and not for people. Mm-hmm. And I think the smart centers, I mean, I don't know. I haven't been into the store yet. I'm not afraid to tell people I'm not interested in shopping there. But I don't think there's any sidewalks there. I don't see any. It's strictly cars.
I'm not aware.
I don't even know how people cross the road to get over there if they want to walk. So I think that speaks volumes of what really you were getting at.
But the issue that I was getting at was that that argument, I do not believe, was acknowledged and refuted, that it would cause further sprawl, and that was a bad thing. Similarly, I don't think that I, in my discussions, really address the issue of shopping. It is a valid issue, not shopping for the sake of shopping, but shopping for the sake of keeping 7 and 8 year olds in clothes when you have to wash them twice a day and they're growing 4 inches a year. There needs to be a source to buy that. And I don't think that issue is really engaged on the anti-side.
Oh, okay. They did not engage in that issue. There was an interesting, I'd love to have a program on it. It came out of New York, actually. I think it was near upstate New York. I'm trying to think of a place where they had a problem, the same kind of a thing, and the people formed some sort of a cooperative, I guess, to provide the goods that were missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, in other words, there are other ways of doing it. Somebody made a comment to me the other day about, why is it this, the question of living wage? And I don't know if all the merchants in Salmon Arm pay a living wage, but there's a particular new store in that smart centers that doesn't. It's fairly well known. And yet they're one of the richest corporations in the world. It begs a few questions. In the same article in 2009, you raise more questions about urban sprawl, and you say many of us hold a vision of Salmon Arm as a city based more on a European city or a North American city of 100 years ago. It envisions a city which is based on the needs of humans rather than being dominated by needs of the automobile. And the contrast is to the mid to late 20th century, a North American city with suburbs and large shopping malls with acres and acres of asphalt parking. I threw in one extra acres there. Continuing with the quote, joined by freeways and multi-lane arterial roads. Are we clear on the type of city we want to live in, and how will this smart center proposal affect us? Now, that's a pretty big question. Do you think there was an answer?
I don't think there was an answer, no. I think if the answer is that the city is divided, then yes, there was an answer. I don't think there was a clear answer that I heard at the public hearings indicating what type of city we want. But I also, as I say, I don't think I heard the arguments. The arguments in favor of the modern 20th century city were more implicit in the fact that we want that development where it is out there, which is a further example of that type of
urban sprawl.
Urban sprawl, yeah.
Or encouraging urban sprawl.
But I heard that they want it there, but I did not hear arguments in favor of, yes, we need more urban sprawl.
Just a year or two ago, we went through, or Sam and I went through, and we're going through it in Area C, this exercise called the Official Community Plan. And that's quite an extensive exercise, is it not, involving public hearings and... is that not an expression by the people of what kind of a town they would like?
That's what it's intended to be, and that's what the process is designed to give. And that's there are public hearings involved in that process, and people are given the opportunity to express their wishes and desires, and the council makes the ultimate decision, as they do, as the elected body. I find little to quarrel with. Well, I find I could raise a lot of arguments, but in its general tone, the official community plan leads us towards it talks about having a dense area with a compact downtown and shopping and all that good stuff that I've been promoting, and it falls down in the implementation when exceptions are made and it's not followed.
Yeah, that seems to be a major concern. Do you know why that it's not followed? Do you think it's the
press? When that official community plan was adopted, there was an urban growth boundary established, which said that there would not be residential, small lot residential development beyond this area. And there's been at least three expansions to that boundary in the 2 years since it was passed. And, and by the virtue of the same council. So, what was the intention when the boundary was passed, and why were there exemptions made? If the intention was to limit development and encourage density, you'll need to ask the councillors that.
Yeah. Very, very interesting, very important point. Before we lose, we're running out of time here, I want to get, we talked about debate and we talked about people not listening to the other side, and we were wondering why, doesn't matter how much information, it seems that the other side isn't listening or isn't addressing the points of the other party. And you sent me this link to this article, and I just want to deal with it just for a moment because I think it's so telling. It says that the title is How Politics Makes Us Stupid. And what was the hypothesis that they dealt with, like this business of everybody thinks, well, if you just get enough information, you'll be able to understand the other side?
Well, the researchers had done some experiments which demonstrated that when people were given information on a relatively neutral question, they evaluated the information and arrived at a decision in line with the conclusions from the information. Where it was a controversial item with political consequences and perhaps a public profile, they looked at the information and interpreted it in a way that suited their
position.
And that occurred whether they were progressives or conservatives. Both sides shared in this distortion of the information to meet their position. So there's a difficulty of when you provide more information, you're not necessarily going to change a mind that's already made up or has a position. The other very interesting part of it was that the coalition or the groups that have coalesced are less diverse than they used to be, and so to express an opinion that goes against your group that you are generally allied with can bring a lot of bad feeling upon you because there isn't the tolerance of diverse ideas. So it makes it much more difficult for people to listen to other people's arguments and then agree with them or raise them within their own group.
It's too bad we don't have more time, Ian. We're running out of time. It's now, we got about 30 seconds left. And in that 30 seconds, I want to thank you very much for coming. And I'm looking forward to next week when we have our panel discussion with you, Tim Lavery, and Louise Wallace.